77 WABC. And now, the longest-running program in the history of 77 WABC, Religion on the Line with Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Thank you. Welcome to Religion on the Line. It is said that there are those in this world who will criticize God for placing thorns on roses. There are others who praise Him for placing roses on thorns. As a person of faith, I always try to look for the positive, try to see the rose in the garden of life. I must say the last few weeks it has been extremely difficult. I am looking at an article written by Ben Ginsberg, who is the son of a rabbi. The title of the article is, After Grieving for Pittsburgh, I Witnessed Thousand Oaks. He was present in the bar when the shooting took place. I want you to hear his words. I now join a painful, grief-stricken fellowship of shooting survivors, a membership that I never wished to seek. There is no plan for this. No one ever expects this to happen to them. Just last week, I met with my rabbi, Paul Kipnis, to talk about the Tree of Life synagogue shooting. I told him, I hate how we talk about preparing for the next time. This was the next time, and there'll be more next time. He told me, I don't need to sugarcoat this with you. It's going to get worse before it gets better. Neither of us imagined that this would be the next time. It couldn't happen here, right? And it did. This was the next time. So it seems that every few weeks, and now even more often than that, we're talking about violence in some part of the country. We saw this in Pittsburgh. Now we see it in California. We saw it in South Carolina. We can look at a map and put points everywhere where tragedies occurred through hatred, through gun violence. And the question always is, so what are we going to do about it? Are we simply going to use that worn-out phrase, thoughts and prayers go out to everyone? What does that get us? Does it make us feel better? It certainly doesn't make the other side feel better. So I'm looking at numbers here where every 3 days, 160 people are murdered through gun violence. And we're just talking about it, not doing anything about it, and not talking about doing something about it, simply throwing up our hands as if there's nothing that can be done. I think we who care, we who have a conscience, we have to do more. Hopefully, this time will be the last time, not there'll be a next time. So I think you're going to find the guest today discussing some of these issues, and hopefully we develop a strategy going forward. Thank you for listening. Religion on the Line.
Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of Religion on the Line on 77 WABC. 77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of Religion on the Line on 77 WABC.
Thank you. This is Rabbi Potasnik. This week we're going to be commemorating Veterans Day, a day in which we take time to remember those who are ready to give their lives to save our lives. And we're here today because of the sacrifices they were ready to make. I thought it'd be appropriate to speak to people who are very, very connected to veterans. And I'm talking to three chaplains, Rabbi Andrew Scheer, Father Andrew Cioletti, Imam Orhan Settin, chaplains from the VA New York Harbor Healthcare System. Thank you all for being with us today. Rabbi, let me begin with you. What does Veterans Day mean on your calendar?
Veterans Day is the day for me that we recognize all of those who have served as well as all of those who are still serving. Our nation, we need our military, we need our veterans, and especially nowadays when we have an all-volunteer force. It's very important that we take this time out on the calendar to say thank you, to say that we appreciate your service, and that we're just very blessed to live in this country, where people feel that they can serve and that they should serve.
Yeah, it's something that I think we take for granted. I know over the years, Veterans Day, should receive full support, and we don't see the attendance we need to see. But you guys, you're there serving veterans who have been injured, those who are paying a heavy price for their service. Father, talk about what chaplains do in the VA system.
I'm Father Andrew Cioletti. And our director, Martina Peruda, likes to say that in the VA, every day is the Veterans Day. So what makes the VA unique is that the veteran who served already had a chaplain when they were military, whether they were in the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. So in VA, our chaplains, many of whom serve in the military themselves, see every patient, no matter what religion they subscribe, or no religion at all. The veteran always has the right to accept and decline a visit.
Mm-hmm. We also have Imam Orhan Settin. In talking with chaplains over the years, you're called into various settings, and when you walk into a room, the religion of the person you're seeing is not the only thing you address. I mean, obviously there is some discussion on religion, but as a chaplain, you're prepared to serve people of all faiths. Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely. This is Imam Orhan Settin. I personally have prayed for and I have been welcomed by veteran patients from faith different than from my own, and their openness let me know it is appreciated and beneficial to them. So, I have held bedside prayers for, and I have interacted with patients of almost all faith traditions, including, I can give an example, that something is very dear to me, including a veteran who as ordained pastor, I visited a number of times. He and I developed a relationship that looked beyond our faith beliefs, and it was based on our common humanity. At first, he thought that I was Christian chaplain, and one day he decided to ask what that denomination I was. I told him I am Muslim, and he was pleasantly surprised. It was actually his first experience getting to know a Muslim person, and I believe this is an example of how human suffering transcends any individual religious belief.
And also, veterans are there for all faiths, so yes. It's not as if a person's faith matters to them in terms of their service. I drive by Veterans Hospital here in Manhattan quite often, and I see a number of Vietnam War veterans. I believe they're Vietnam War veterans because that's what it says on the hats they wear. Do you feel that veterans feel that they have been underappreciated, they've been forgotten? And that's a question for any of you who want to respond.
When I speak to the Vietnam veterans, I was actually just in the room of a Vietnam veteran this morning. There was a group of school children that was going around handing out thank you for your service, asking them. And when the school kids left the room, the Vietnam veteran, he started crying. And he said, until today, nobody had ever thanked him for his service. Nobody had ever appreciated him or acknowledged him. And he shared with me the experience of what it was like for him coming back, which is quite different than the experience our returning servicemen and women get today. So I think there's still some lingering moral injury, maybe, a little bit of trauma that they weren't welcomed back, but thankfully we're rectifying that today. And the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans have had a completely different experience when they've come home. Thank God.
So what does that say to us as citizens in terms of our responsibility to them? Obviously, over the years, there's been talk of increasing funding for veteran services. But what else can we do as citizens? Any of you, Father, Imam?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
What do you think we can do in terms of the moral injury Rabbi Shear just spoke about? Is there something we can do to help address that? Something,
yes.
What would you suggest?
Very, very important, Rabbi Potasnik. Moral injury is when a service member acts against their moral conscience in war, and we teach in our houses of worship, thou shalt not kill. What happens is then when the service member is put in a position where they have to take somebody's life. They come home, they feel shame over what they have trained to do so. As chaplains, we work with our returning veterans and women to process their experience. So what we do as chaplains, we work together with the team to be able to get some sort of inner peace through our sharing together and through our work together in their spiritual journey.
And I think what Father Cialetti is really touching on there is that we need to welcome people back.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do a better job of that. Funding only goes so far. Mental health treatment only goes so far. And as religious leaders in our houses of worship, if we're not welcoming people back and making sure that they know that they have a space, and whether it's a synagogue or a mosque or a church, and recognizing their service, that I think does more than anything else can. Anything that any government funding, anything like that.
Imam, I'm talking to three chaplains. of three different faiths. And I've known Rabbi Scheer for some time, and he's to me, he's one of the best. He's always ready to do a mitzvah, a good deed. Just for a moment, talk about relationships that you share with one another. I don't think people recognize sometimes the closeness we enjoy as members of the human family. Touch on that. Imam?
Yes. I recently had an experience of meeting and providing pastoral care for an African-American veteran patient. He was about 50 years old in the substance abuse unit who spent much of his life moving around. And he struggled with relationships and addiction much of his life. And during this suffering, he slowly lost his faith. He felt severe depression, hopelessness. He said he tried to pray, but he couldn't approach God because of guilt he felt for and then his past mistakes. After listening to his story, I tried to provide a message of hope and to have faith in God's endless mercy. And I tried to do my best to comfort him by telling we all make mistakes and that God is all-knowing, all-compassionate, and understands our weaknesses. I told him not to give up his prayers and that I understand his struggle to get closer to God while enduring such struggles, and that God is more understanding than all. It seemed it had been a long time since he had been able to open about his faith, and it was clear a great burden had been lifted off his chest after he was able to confess his feelings. At the end of our first meeting, he told me that he felt it was the start of a new day for mm-hmm. him, and that he would be more comfortable approaching God with his struggles and would begin to start praying again.
Father Andrew Cialetti, Rabbi Andrew Scheer, Imam Orhan Seton, thank you so much reminding us that there are many branches, but we all share the same roots. And thank you for all you do as chaplains at the VA New York Harbor Healthcare System. We are most grateful to you for the selfless service you provide as well.
Rabbi Potasnik?
Yes.
Just a last thing. If you're a veteran who's listening and yet not receiving care at VA, please stop and see us. You can also call our outreach coordinator, 212-686-7500, extension 4218, and also the Veteran Crisis Line, 1-800-237-8255, press 1. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Have a meaningful Veterans Day. All of us should have a meaningful Veterans Day.
77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of Religion on the Line on 77 WABC.
Thank you. This is Rabbi Potasnik. Deacon McCormick is on our conference line. And Deacon, I was so moved a few moments ago when I said to our board operator, Michael Caraglione, a.k.a. Crash, let's get Deacon McCormick. He said, who is he?
Yeah, the big guy. He used to be. Who was he?
Who's Deacon McCormick, right?
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
All right, it's like the reunion of the Righteous Brothers. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Well, it's always good to be with you, Joe.
Yeah. So here we are post-election, and there was a discussion years ago amongst a group of theologians, what's the most important phrase in the Bible? And someone said, and it came to pass, because it really refers to the day after some momentous event. What are you going to do that day? What are you going to do during that period? And I think that's the question we have to ask. Certainly we who are in the arena need to ask ourselves, what has to be done? So we saw the results. I have my interpretation. I'm sure you have yours. I think there's a responsibility. I think people are tired of the divisiveness, tired of the demonization, the kind of immature behavior that we've seen for too long. I think they're saying we want two parties to come together and to work on our behalf. There are many issues that need to be resolved, and we're not going to accomplish anything by just hurling these names at one another.
That's 100% right, and I think whether you look at people who are from the left or the right or the blue or the red or the north or the south or the east or the west, that's what everybody is really asking for, is sanity and maturity. And I don't know if the parties that be, both sides, are prepared for this yet. You still have people that, like, now it's our turn. You know, mm-hmm. And rather than saying, like, well, now we might be in a position where we can start a dialogue, move forward, and maybe we can't. Maybe the parties that we have involved here are just so set in their ways that they don't know any other mode of behavior. But a lot of people are suffering because of it. And that's the thing that I see in my communities, my faith community, my school community, my family, my friends. There's really this great yearning, desire, a begging for adults to start acting like adults.
You know, I was talking to my son the other day, and he follows, you know, the political climate. He said, I've reached a point where I don't even want to read the news. I don't even want to hear what's going on, because all it is about fighting with each other. And it's, you know, it's been like we elect people who go to Washington and then forget their constituents. They think it's about them and it's supposed to be about us. And you got to come back and say, look, we were able to accomplish the following, or we tried to accomplish the following. And all we hear is the name-calling and pointing a finger at the other side. Look, I think the president bears responsibility here. I think the result of the election was a repudiation of some of his behavior. I think in other cases it was a repudiation of members of the other party, of the Democratic Party. But I think all in all, people are saying to both sides, stop it and start behaving, as you say, in a mature way. And we as religious leaders, you know, we try to tell people to respond to the higher source, to the higher power, to the higher inner being. And we haven't seen that in some time. And as I mentioned to you before, we can talk about civility, you and I, so you and I can be civil. Then we go outside and hear the others and say, wait a minute, they didn't hear our lecture.
Right. And nor do they have any desire to, because, again, we've talked about this so many times over the years. We're at a point now where the gift of humility is completely gone. So I know the truth, and I am so pleased to know that I've been given that ability to see the perception of the way God sees things. And anybody who strays from mine has no rights. We used to say ignorance has no rights in some of the older philosophies. And the idea that may be true, but we need to kind of come to terms with the fact that we don't have all the answers. Republicans don't have all the answers. Democrats don't have all the answers. And look, it's like a broken record, but if we don't, we already see cracks. I think we see cracks in the society. You know, how many shootings are we going to have? Mm-hmm. You know, and that used to be something you and I would talk about, and we'd shake our heads, and, you know, guns don't kill people. You know, people kill people. Bullets, I don't know what it is. I know a lot of people are dying. I know a lot of people are angry. People go into a shul. Do they go into a bar in a college? They shoot people up. Is President Trump responsible for that? No. No, let's be real. He's not. But has he and his counterparts on the other side, have they raised the tenor of discussion to the point now where we can do these things and expect them to be positive actions? My God, we have. You know, I tell you, Joe, I go to bed at night and I shake my head and I pray to God that my children will somehow be saved from all this.
I began the program today talking about a young man who happens to be a son of a rabbi who was in that bar. And, you know, you wonder, and he wonders, is this becoming the new norm? And what is the statistic? 160 people are killed every 3 days through mm-hmm. gun violence?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously thoughts and prayers are not going to solve the day. And when are we going to seriously, you know, confront the challenge of all of these guns in our society? We can't just simply say, well, it's the people, it's not the guns. It's the people and the guns together. It's a dangerous mix. Now, we're not going to solve every problem. But my God, maybe there'll be fewer deaths. Isn't that an accomplishment? I mean, how can we look ourselves in the eye? How can politicians look at themselves in the eye and say we've done everything humanly possible to prevent deaths? They can't, because they haven't done anything.
And now you also see a challenge on the you know, those who believe that the Constitution, it was written the way it was written and it needs to be interpreted with the words that are present, except when it comes to the 14th Amendment. And then we say, well, you know, we didn't mean that if you were born in the country, you have citizenship.
Yeah.
You know, that to me is the most frustrating, I guess, because I was trained, you know, in some sort of logic that there needs to be consistency. And really, we're in a game now where I just want to beat you. I want to beat you at the game we're playing. And unfortunately, it's not a game. It's our lives. And it's, you know, I do think the Lord weeps a lot when he looks at his children these days.
I was encouraged to see so many new people voting. There are people who had not voted before who are coming out now. And I think they're saying we need a change of direction. We can't go the same way. And what's interesting I found is that here we are, the economy is doing well, the unemployment numbers are down, and yet people were saying it's not enough. The moral climate is not what it should be, and we need to improve that, you know, that temperature, lower the temperature. And I think that's why you're seeing people coming out and saying, hey, character counts, yeah, behavior counts. It's not just about the dollars.
No. No, it's not. And we really do need to have, begin to have a reckoning. You know, this week, Joe, there's a very big event in the Catholic Church. The bishops are meeting down in Baltimore in the middle of the week. And the same thing is happening in the church, in the sense that people are demanding more accountability, more clarity, more openness, more discussion. And there is a real pain that's in my church right now, that the question of, you know, can we trust our leaders?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you could be on whatever side you want on that, but it's really corrupting. The whole society seems to be like crumbling right in front of us. And you know, Joe, I'm going to say it, because if you do, they'll say, oh, he's Jewish and stuff like this. I'm worried about my Jewish brothers and sisters. I'm worried about what civility is there. I'm worried about your ability to be in a shul and pray to the same God I'm praying to, and not being safe. I'm worried about the fact that kids are putting swastikas up in classrooms,
mm-hmm,
and there's a problem with that. You know, is this 1935? It's not. But you know what? Maybe it's 1932. You know, and I do think we need to stand and say civility in our churches, in our schools, in our homes, in our Senate, in our Congress, in our White House, in our homes.
I was talking with Rabbi Jeffrey Myers. He's the rabbi of Tree of Life, and he was in the sanctuary when the madman came in and murdered people. And just talking to him, and I had met him years ago, he said, look, I'll never be the same. I'll never forget the sounds of, you know, those shots. I'll never forget looking and seeing people murdered in front of my eyes. And that synagogue is not going to be open for a while, but, you know, you return to the synagogue and you say, life will never be the same.
And Joe, what were those people guilty of?
Being Jewish.
Yeah.
You know? And by the way, we've seen this in a church in South Carolina.
Yep.
And here we always tell everybody sacred space, safe space. We say all the right things, but we see some of the wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a rabbi who, I must say, I commended him for his courageous leadership, because he is trying to bring the community together, but it's a community that's broken. You know, they came back for services, not in that building, but we had this call Show Up Shabbat, and we had Solidarity Sabbath last week, and people came in droves. They said, we're not going to be deterred because of the dastardly act of some crazy guy. And that was encouraging, but still, how do you explain it? How do you explain someone going into a sanctuary and shooting people who, as you say, guilty of nothing?
Right.
Except fulfilling the precept of their faith, praying in a shul. What? You know, we always talked about, you know, safest place has always been in a sanctuary.
Right, right, right.
And now we're talking about, well, how should we protect the sanctuary? Do we have armed guards, non-armed guards? Do we, you know, have magnetometers? What do we do now? And congregations are speaking to police. And by the way, congregations of different faiths, because you and I have learned the guy who hates me today will hate you tomorrow.
That's 100% right. I was speaking with my students right after the event in Pennsylvania, and you know, we gathered the guys together, and I was with the seniors in a seminar. And I said, what was Germany like in 1914, 1915? And a kid stood up and he said, Deacon Mack, it was the most civilized country in the world. And I said, you can make a very strong case for that, for culture, for philosophy, for theology, for business, for industry, the whole nine yards. And then another kid said, well, how'd that all change in 20 years? And I think what we have to be very careful about is that, and people much brighter than I have said this, our way of life is very fragile and needs to be defended at all times. And the minute we take it for granted, the minute we envelop ourselves into a complacency, that's when the cancer grows. And I fear that we see this beginning. And if I'm an alarmist, so be it. But we need to stand together and say, enough! We can't do this!
I have friends of mine this past week who have been in Germany, because this is the 80th anniversary of Kristallnacht.
Right, right, right.
So a group of rabbis, I couldn't go because of all that was going on here, but I've been in touch with them. And You know, they said it was very moving. They were in Berlin. They were at the Holocaust Memorial. They're in the Holocaust Museum. And all the right things are being said about remembrance. We can't forget. They also were told by some, better not wear those yarmulkes in public places.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, we're talking one way, and things are not going that way in other places. But you're right. America has always been different. America is not Europe. We can't let it become Europe. And therefore, people have to exercise their freedom in every possible way. I was encouraged by the turnout of the election. I think people are saying, we want to say in our country, we're not going to just leave it to others to decide. We want to have, you know, participation here. So maybe that's the message, that if we're going to see change, if we're going to do things better, we all need to come together, right, left, whatever you call yourself. We can't solve it with just one group.
I was very impressed with a lot of young people, my daughters included, who got themselves involved. You know, they found a cause in the election. They didn't necessarily agree with me or disagree with me. They had their own points of view that they had developed from their experience, and they were involved. And you know, they went to great pains to make sure they got into the voting booth. They owned it. You know, it was to talk about enfranchising as opposed to disenfranchising. They were I was really taken back by that. And they were watching returns, and there was, you know, happiness and joy, and there was horror, and, you know, oh my God, what's going to happen? And my youngest daughter said something to the effect of, like, oh my God, this is real life. I said, yeah, it kind of is, isn't it?
You know, I went to vote, and it was a long line, and it's one of the few times in my life I didn't mind waiting in line.
Yeah.
I said, what a privilege, what an honor, and what a responsibility. As a matter of fact, I was telling a person near me, we're talking about our different religions. I said, I think we would agree, I think religion mandates voting. Because we all believe you have to support the country in which you live in a meaningful way. Voting is a responsibility we have to take seriously. So it was good to see all those people. And let's see, hope. Look, we are a people. We are prisoners of hope.
Yes.
You know, because we believe where there's hope, there's life. Thank you, Deacon.
Hey, always, Rabbi. Always a pleasure to be with you.
I don't see enough of you. And I look forward to just talking to you as often as I can.
Are you paying for the meal?
Always.
Okay.
It's a tradition.
That's why I like to say.
On the roof. It's a tradition.
Let's not ruin it.
Thanks so much. Deacon Kevin McCormick, love you.
Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of religion on the line on 77 WABC. 77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of religion on the line on 77 WABC.
This is Rabbi Potasnik. Thanks for listening to Religion on the Line. In a world that has seen insanity, it is most reassuring to know there are some sane people in leadership positions. One of those people is a good friend, Evan Bernstein, who's regional director of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. And you have seen and heard Evan much in the past few weeks, and it's a voice that needs to be heard. And I think he can give us greater insight as to what's going on with the rise in hate crime. So let's go to the conference line. Speak with Evan Bernstein. Hi, Evan.
Rabbi, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for your service to the community, because you're one we can always count on to tell us, give us an update as to what's going on. So the police commissioner this past week spoke of the increase in hate crimes. You've spoken about it. It's not a secret. It's something we need to talk about. We can't hide it. We can't sugarcoat it. Tell us what's happening.
Well, I think there's really, you know, there's different parts of hate and anti-Semitism that's taking place right now, you know, across New York and New York State. I think we have, you know, clearly a rise of white supremacist activity that we're seeing online, kind of flyering white supremacist activity that's taking place on college campuses across New York. And we're seeing more and more rhetoric from those kind of groups throughout the state. And there's another part, which is the largest part of what the commissioner talked about at his press conference at the Museum of Jewish Heritage, was the rise of, you know, vandalism, anti-Semitic vandalism, which is a hate crime, which is making right now up the majority of the hate crimes that are taking place. And, you know, the recent numbers that we also saw was between October 1st and before October 28th, there were 31 anti-Semitic hate crimes in New York, which is just staggering. And I think, you know, those are crimes that are much harder to pinpoint exactly where they are. When there's a swastika on the door or someone writes the word Jew, or, you know, those kinds of things, especially when there's no videotape, it's very, very hard to figure out who is doing that, who's behind that. Is it white supremacist? Is it others? We don't know. And it's the hardest crime for police officers to be able to solve, and we know that. They're doing everything in their power. The NYPD Hate Crimes Task Force is amazing, and they're doing everything, but some of these things are just, you know, incredibly hard and difficult, and we have to understand that as a society. Then there's the other kinds of more aggressive anti-Semitic acts, which we've seen. You know, we've already seen 12 anti-Semitic assaults this year in New York, 9 of which have been in Brooklyn, of which, you know, really have been in the Orthodox communities in Brooklyn. And those are not being done by white supremacists. Those are being done by other people in the community, and which is also challenging and has its own challenges. And there's been challenges in that community in relations between the Jewish and non-Jewish community in Brooklyn, you know, dating back even before the Crown Heights riots. So I think that there's a lot of complexity. There's a lot of angles here. There's no one particular, you know, right answer. There's lots of answers, but the bottom line is anti-Semitism is on the rise, and we're seeing numbers that even NYPD is saying that they haven't seen in an incredibly long time.
Evan, I think many people have heard that hate mongers have been emboldened, that they feel that they can say things they used to whisper, they can do things they used to cover up in some way. They're, it's much more in the open. Any sense as to why there's been that kind of change?
Well, I think there's two fronts to that. One is you've seen, you know, online the amount of vitriol and hate that's online right now, and you saw that with Robert Bowers, who was the murderer of 11 in Pittsburgh. That he was on Gab, he was online, he was communicating with others, posting his hateful thoughts and messaging before he committed that horrific act. So many people right now are communicating on blogs, they're communicating through podcasts, through Facebook, Twitter, other devices that are allowing for people to communicate and also share their thoughts, which then rises, the climate of hate rises in our society, because these kind of things are not just around the burning cross like they were in the days of the Klan. It's they're much more readily available to everybody. And, you know, as I've been saying, like, someone in New York can communicate with haters across the globe or in other parts of this country in real time, and that leads to people sharing ideas, sharing these kind of values, and the normalization begins, and then it becomes normal to act out on those hateful thoughts. That's one component, for sure, online. The other part. The other part is our leaders in our community. And one example that we've been calling out, you know, frequently has been Louis Farrakhan. You know, Louis Farrakhan recently called Jews termites. He has influence. He is considered a leader in his community. People listen to what Louis Farrakhan says. And when someone like that makes such incredibly disparaging remarks to those in his constituent base, people that are, you know, that are in his world that have maybe never even met a Jew, and never interacted with a Jew, don't know a Jew, they take that as gospel, they take that as the word, that's what Jews are, they're termites, and they're going to see people in that way. And that also can lead to people acting out, you know, in hate. And I think that there needs to be even more calling out of people that are throwing out that kind of rhetoric into the public space, and we need to do everything in our power to push back on it.
And, you know, when we talk about Farrakhan, he doesn't stand alone. There are people who stand with him and try to somehow camouflage, well, you know, what he said was, it doesn't matter what he says, and, you know, he doesn't have that kind of impact. Therefore, you have a women's march where, you know, Linda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory, they will stand with him proudly or support him proudly. And I don't get it. I don't understand how you can claim to be a moral leader and stand with someone who's immoral.
Because I think anti-Semitism is the oldest form of hate. And I think anti-Semitism is something that, unfortunately, is accepted in a lot of circles still, even though a lot of members of the Jewish community have felt that it was long, you know, long gone. When I started 5 years ago, many of my leaders thought that we should really only be focusing on the other and not on anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism was dead. And, you know, it's been an incredibly rude awakening for them, especially over the last few years. And I think, you know, that's a challenge that we have, is understanding that anti-Semitism is really happening here and happening at very high levels, and there are people that still feel this way and are willing to do publicly and are getting away with it. And we can't, as a society, continue to let that happen.
We had a conference this past week where we brought in young people on campuses. And as you know, Evan, what's happening on campuses is the word disgraceful is being mild, because here you have a campus that's supposed to be what, the marketplace of ideas, has become a minefield for kids who are pro-Israel.
Yeah, I mean, pro-Israel and even Jewish. You know, we've seen 100% increase. Last year we saw 100% increase in anti-Semitic incidents on college campuses in New York State. And so this is a huge problem. You're right. When a lot of Zionist kids right now that are pro-Israel and they want to be involved in other social issue things on campus, it's called intersectionality, and they're being knocked out of the box because they're pro-Israel, but yet they also want to be for the other as well. And that space is becoming smaller and smaller, or almost non-existent on a lot of campuses. Now, there's thousands and thousands of campuses across the country, and not all these campuses have those issues. But a lot of the campuses that our kids go to, they're having those problems. And that is something we have to be very open to trying to solve and work with. I deal with parents, Rabbi, all the time that just weren't expecting their kids to have to experience this on college campuses. And they're having an incredibly rude awakening, and their kids are not prepared for what they're expecting and what they're experiencing. And, you know, that's our job, and the ADL does that. We have a Words to Action program where we go and train juniors and seniors and freshmen in college so these parents and children can understand what they're going to experience and have the tools to be able to push back and react to what they're seeing. And it's really difficult and very hard.
I was talking to some parents recently and saying we wait too long to equip our kids so they are prepared for this. And for too long, we didn't do anything because we didn't see the problem as manifest as it is today. But, you know, you can't wait for a kid to be a year away from college and then start arming that person, you know, intellectually with the truth about Israel and how to defend Israel in an appropriate fashion. Criticism of Israel is acceptable. Demonization of Israel is unacceptable.
Absolutely. Yeah. The legit critique of Israel is a normal thing. Israelis do it to themselves at the highest level internally. Again, you're right. When it crests over into anti-Semitism, where Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister, is considered Hitler, or it's Israel is a Nazi state, that's when things crest over. The challenge, I think, a lot of parents, lived in, their own versions of shtetls, whether it's the Orthodox shtetl, the conservative movement shtetl, or even the Reform shtetl, and these kids have never thought they would have to experience this, or the parents, because everyone around them in the social circle was very, very similar. There wasn't necessarily that same melting pot. They get to a campus that is a melting pot of ideas in different kinds of colors, creeds, religions, and that's where it's popping up, and you're right, they're just not prepared. Not prepared.
So before we let you go, Evan, there are people out there who are asking, so what can I do? I am concerned. Where can I help make a difference?
I think the biggest thing is, on the issue we just talked about is get your kid educated before they get to college campus. Call the ADL office. We'll come out to your synagogue. We'll come to your day school. We'll come to your Sunday school. We will work with you and your parent, the children, the parents, to get them ready to understand what they're going to expect when that college experience happens. That's number one. Number two is get involved in the process, with getting people educated. We need more anti-bias in the schools. Hate to learn behavior. Is anti-bias education happening in your kid's school or your grandkid's school or your niece and nephew's school? Because it should be. And if it's not, we can also help do that at the ADL. We're one of the number one providers of anti-bias education across New York, especially for the DOE here in New York City. And we want to help. We want to be able to get into more schools. So that's a proactive way of pushing back on hate and also holding your elected officials accountable. We've had many issues recently where there's been anti-Semitic incidents and the elected officials are not speaking out. Community leaders are not speaking out. It's becoming normalized. And as constituents in these, districts, we have to ensure that our elected officials are speaking out and acting on behalf of us and really ensuring that this normalization of hate and anti-Semitism does not continue, and that really has to start at the elected level as well.
That's why the turnout at this past election was very heartening, because you saw people who said, we are demanding a difference, and we're not going to put up with the status quo, we're not going to be complacent, and I think that's part of the answer. Is let people, make their voices heard, go to various meetings, send the letters to the editor, do what they can to say, I've done whatever I need to do to change the climate.
That's right.
And ADL, right. And ADL, of course, has been on the forefront of that. I want to go back for a moment to the cyber hate.
Yes.
What, you know, free speech, obviously, you know, we know about free speech, but that's government, you know. What about these websites? Why can't they be shut down?
Well, they can't. I mean, Gab, you know, which Robert Bowers was on, has basically lost all of its funding, and I don't believe they're even up at this point. One of the, you know, the challenges, these are private entities. We understand free speech. The ADL is a fervent supporter of free speech. We have been for over 100 years. It's that these are private platforms, and the platforms of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, they have the ability to monitor what mm-hmm. is on their websites and on their platforms and pull things off if it's hate speech, and because it is a private entity. And that's why we opened up an office just a few years ago in Silicon Valley, our Center for Technology and Society, is to help be in the backyard of these companies and hold them accountable for this kind of thing. Because as constituents, we need to also, people are paying for these services to be on these platforms. We have a right to ensure that they are doing their job as a private entity to be the best partner in our society. And that's not free speech. These, again, because they're private entities, they have the ability to pull down this kind of speech, whether it's Holocaust denial or other kinds of hate speech. And that's why we're in their backyard and helping them try to do that.
What's the pushback you get? How do they defend their position by keeping this stuff, you know, on the platform?
You're dealing with, in some of these platforms, millions and millions of hits and tweets and activity per second. Millions and millions. And for any company to try to do that, and they're trying to use algorithms, they're trying to use other ways to monitor this kind of hate. The other thing is, a lot of these companies have been very much about research and development of their platforms. You know, they have shareholders, and it's about developing a company and building the company. And for a lot of them, you know, that's their first instinct is not to be necessarily socially responsible. It's about how they're going to build a better business, a better platform. Now that these businesses become more established, they're certainly listening to us. We're meeting with their general counsels. We're talking with the leadership. We have those relationships, and it's a work in progress. But it's certainly where we feel hate is gone. Hate is going to go way more and more from the public square, and it's going to go very much online. We're seeing that even after post Charlottesville, there was going to be more events after Charlottesville that are similar, and they pulled everything online because they were afraid of facial recognition and they don't want to be in the public square. And you can be hidden now online, and again, reach many more people a lot faster, more effectively online.
So you know that we have a holiday known as Purim, and we always make noise when Haman is recited. The name of Haman is said.
Right, get the grogger out.
Right, get Spin the grogger out. And I always find after people, kids in particular, make the noise, there are always those who go, shh, shh, try to quiet them down. Maybe the lesson all of this is Haman is out there, and we can't be shushers.
That's right.
We don't have the luxury anymore of just keeping quiet, looking the other way. So I just want to say thank you. Thank you for reminding us, as you often do, of our responsibility. We are people of conscience, hopefully, and conscience dictates response. You can't simply say it's going to go away. It hasn't gone away, and it won't go away unless we do something about it.
That's right.
Evan Bernstein, Regional Director of ADL Anti-Defamation League. Thanks for being with us today.
Rabbi, thank you so much. And thanks for everything you do. Really, thank you.
Thank you. I want to say thank you to all of you for listening this week and every week to Religion Online. These are difficult subjects that we have to discuss, but they're necessary if we're going to find a resolution for some of these problems.
77 WABC.